So I want to continue today with what we know about the systematics of rotation curves, which, as I say, are now a lot more than when we established the dark matter problem. That the issue was really established in the late 70s by a lot of observations, but the key one was that rotation curves became flat and stayed that way out beyond what you could explain by the stars and disks. Okay, so last time we'd gotten about through talking about that, and that the amplitude of that flat rotation speed correlated with the mass of galaxies. And there's basically no scatter from that. It doesn't depend on the distribution of that mass, which is kind of weird, so let's think about this anymore. So here's an example of a Tully-Fisher pair. These are two galaxies with basically the same integrated mass and the same rotation speed, or at least a flat part of the rotation speed. But very different mass distributions. So UGC 128 is one of the prototypical low surface brightness galaxies. It's very spread out, has a large disk scale length and a low central surface brightness compared to the similar mass NGC 2403. So if we plot our surface brightness profile, log surface brightness, so surface brightness profile falls off very steeply for 2403. Very gradually for 128. The central surface brightness of that thing is lower, but the disk scale length is larger. And so it happens to integrate up to the same amount of light. And you can find lots of examples of galaxies that do that. And when you look at their rotation curves, you find that their flat rotation speeds are basically indistinguishable. And so here's the full rotation curve of each of those things. And the integrated mass is the same. The rotation speed, the flat rotation speed, is basically the same within the errors. But the mass models are different, and the shapes of the rotation curves are different. So the Tully-Fisher relation just tells you about global quantities, total mass, stars and gas, whatever you can see, and that flat rotation speed, or V peak or V max, whatever you get, some characteristic of the whole system. But the detailed distributions can be different, so you can see by eye the difference in the light distribution, and if you build a mass model of that, basically use that fitted surface brightness profile to work out what the rotation curve would be of a test particle orbiting in the gravitational potential of the stars and the gas. Then that's that line for this one, the blue line for that one. That's usually what we call a mass model, which is a little, I always found that terminology strange, because all you're doing is taking the observed light distribution, still have to assume a mass to light ratio, and then you're solving Poisson's equation numerically to find out what the gravitational potential corresponding to the observed light distribution is, and representing it as a rotation curve. So it's not really a model, it's a representation of the data, but you do have to pick a mass to light ratio because you always observe the light and not the mass. Okay. So since the light is more concentrated for this NGC galaxy, then V squared goes as GM over R, so the baryonic mass model peaks at a smaller radius and has a higher amplitude, right? The same amount of mass, but over a different radius, so V squared goes as GM over R, so the observed stars explains a bigger fraction of the total than in this case than in that case, the total rotation. And as I described last time, this was known when I started working on it. Galaxies were thought to be close to maximal disks. That is, most of the inner part of the rotation curve is explained by the stars. And so I imagined that low surface brightness galaxies were stretched out versions of that. And I imagine that was true for the dark matter halo as well, and that, in fact, that was why they were low surface brightness. And so then I made the prediction that there should be a shift in Tully-Fisher. I thought this should extend flat out here instead of up there. And you can see the data clearly falsify that idea. So what that leads to is the inference is that low surface brightness galaxies are dark matter dominated. That is to say, the amplitude of the mass discrepancy is large, all the way to pretty small radii. Whereas that's not true for high surface brightness galaxies like this one. You don't really need dark matter until you get far enough out. In either case, if you get far enough out, there's a clear discrepancy. It's just that the amplitude sets in sooner, and that's a systematic function of surface brightness. The lower the surface brightness, the bigger the discrepancy, and the sooner it sets in terms of radius. Okay. So those things were not known when the dark matter paradigm was established. And so there are a lot of models that appear in the literature that were immediately ruled out by that, as was mine. And people don't always know about these things, so they still produce models that are easily ruled out, which is why I'm teaching it. Okay. So, going back to Tully-Fisher now, there really was no residual. I just showed you one pair of galaxies. Here are a bunch of galaxies, and I've color-coded them by their surface brightness. That's the highest surface brightness bin, and a couple of intermediate bins, and then the lowest surface brightness bin. And you can see it doesn't matter. All of those things are on the same Tully-Fisher relation. And that was not expected at the time, right? So again, the reasoning, this goes back to Aronson et al, 1979. The reasoning is just what I sketched out on the board last time, that Newton tells you this, V squared goes as gm over r. You think you can derive this Tully-Fisher relation by squaring that, recognizing that a piece of this is a surface density. And then you have the fourth power of the velocity. And that was true for the H-band Tully-Fisher relation, more or less at the time, the right slope. That this was explained, provided that the surface density was always the same. And at the time, there was this thing called Freeman's Law that said, yeah, we observe all these things to have pretty much the same surface brightness. As I mentioned, that was a selection effect. We specifically looked at things that violated that, and these other lines are the prediction. All right, the shift that is predicted by this argument is not subtle. All right, so basically for every bin of surface brightness, you should shift off of that, and that's clearly not happening. So this is important to go back to the philosophy of science now, say it over and over again, but a theory is only as good as its prior. Have to have a prediction. Here was a prediction. It failed to falsify it. Just saying, oh, there's dark matter does not by itself constitute a theory, because that doesn't make a prediction. You actually have to develop a model that makes a prediction before it becomes science. So dark matter is an inference, and that particular flavor of dark matter theory was falsified by the data. Galaxies do not scale, the sizes of galaxies do not scale with their dark matter halo as I thought they might. Okay, so one can look at a residual from that. So here's Tully-Fisher, there's a fit. You can ask, okay, how far do galaxies deviate from that? So that's the residuals plotted. Plotted here. So those are velocity residuals. Now it's a function of size residuals. So previous plot showed surface brightness. As we've already shown,
right? The luminosity of an exponential disk is just... So only two of the three of these things are independent, right? If you know a luminosity and a size, then you can infer a surface brightness. So the lack of surface brightness residuals from Tully Fisher is the same as saying there's a lack of size residuals. And that's what you see. So here's residuals of the size from plot of size and flat velocity. But remember, this correlates really well with mass, so it's the same as saying size and mass. And there's a big scatter in that, right? You can fit a line, and then you can ask what the deviations from that line are, just as you do for the velocity in Tully-Fisher plane. And there are basically no residuals in velocity, but there's a huge residual in size. Some galaxies are very compact, some galaxies are very diffuse. That's the range from high surface brightness to low surface brightness. And again, that's weird. You can ask, okay, differentially, how does this work? And you expect this slope, again, just from Newton. And that's the dotted red line. That's what you predict if galaxies are maximal. And the only way to avoid this is to sneeze. Excuse me. So. The only way to avoid this is to make galaxies submaximal so that the stars never matter. You can go back and look at our mass model. Right. We had to assume a mass to light ratio there. That's a reasonable one for stellar populations, but you could assume something unreasonable, make that much smaller. Let's assume a spherical disk for simplicity. Of course, that's not what's done there. But there are now two components. Baryonic component, and there's a dark matter component, and they both have the same general form. And of course, if there's a disk, then there's some number of order unity out here that accounts for that geometry. But this is the functional form that matters. And so one way to make sure that you don't have any residual in Tully-Fisher is, okay, the baryons have no mass. Set that to zero, and then you're just looking at that part, right? So the only hypothesis you need now to explain Tully-Fisher is that galaxies of the same luminosity live in halos of the same dark matter mass. Does this picture look right to you? Well, what does this predict? The baryons don't matter. Should there be a Tully-Fisher relation at all? Not really obvious, is it? But the other thing it predicts is that if this is really what's going on, then the shape of the rotation curve should not depend on the mass distribution of the baryons. It only depends on that of the dark matter. So the standard sort of idea is that, okay, all the galaxies live in an NFW halo, that dark matter is dominated. And that basically means that the entire rotation curve should have the shape that's predicted for NFW, not just V-flat. Right? So it's not just the amplitude of the rotation curve that matters there. But that's manifestly not true. Right? You look at the shape of the rotation curves, and there's a difference there. Right? V of R should be the same if all you're looking at is the dark matter. And while that becomes true at large radii, it's not true at small radii. And in fact, the shape depends on the light distribution in exactly the same sense that you would at least qualitatively expect. Right? So the high surface brightness things have rotation curves that rise steeply. R is small for the observed mass.
low surface brightness things have large R for the same mass, so they have a more gradually rising rotation curve. So it's like everything starts out nice and Newtonian, and then at some point we just, oh, we forget about radius. It's kind of weird. So that simplest way of doing that is not possible. And there are models in the literature that attempt to do that. Or express surprise that that's the case, even though it's been known for a long time. Okay, so here's a quick summary of Tully-Fisher. Fundamentally, it's a relation between the baryonic mass and the rotation speed. It doesn't really care whether it's stars or gas, but it's the sum of those things that matter. Nowhere in there is the dark matter mentioned. So on the one hand, we need the dark matter to make the flat rotation speed stay up there. On the other hand, it doesn't appear on the mass axis at all. The amplitude is pretty well calibrated at this point and has been for 20 years. It's always between this range. And one sort of nifty thing is if, you know, a lot of times in astronomy we have power law relations between apparently unrelated or only quasi-related quantities. And you get some weird slope. It's, you know, L goes as M to the 3.5 and the main sequence mass luminosity relation is for stars. And that's just, you know, a log slope. These slopes only have real physics units when they're integer slopes. And so if the slope is exactly 4, then this number has an actual physics value. If it's not, then it's sort of like, you know, if the slope is 3.5, then it's okay, kilometers to the minus 3.5, so I guess it's the 3.5, that's kind of weird. But it's literally up around 4. Most of the scatter that we see is just from stellar M to L, right? We observe the light, we need to know the mass, and that is the one thing we can never make go away, so there's always some scatter. But if you ask a stellar population model how much scatter should I expect, it's comparable to what's observed. So the intrinsic scatter is very small. Maybe a zero, you can never measure zero, so all you can say is it's really, really small, which is strange for galaxies. Galaxies just don't do that. Okay, so we've talked about these two things so far. There's more, so we'll go through that. And these have to do with the shapes of rotation curves, right? It's just a flat rotation speed. That flat rotation speed correlates with the mass. This has to do with the central surface brightness, and these with the shapes of the rotation curves and those correlations. Okay, so again, the shapes of rotation curves and not just the flat rotation speed. It's been known for a long time. So here are just a few examples. Different mass galaxies plotted on the same scale, so the small galaxy doesn't go out as far as the big galaxy. But you can see the amplitude of V flat changes, but you also notice a systematic change in the shape of the rotation curve. And so Vera Rubin noticed this. This is the earliest I know this being pointed out. It's 1980, and she defined this quantity kappa, which is basically when the threshold, when the velocity reaches 100 kilometers a second, that radius in terms of isofoldal radii. So that's using the size of the galaxy as your yardstick. Again, the thing to always keep separate here is the distinction between physical radii and isofoldal radii or scale lengths or some measure of the light distribution. The dark matter doesn't care about what the scale length of the light is. Its prediction is in actual radii in kiloparsecs. And here she's saying, well, you know, I noticed this trend with shape, and that depends on the size of the observed galaxy, which seems reasonable. It's also pointed out by Persic and Salucci And here's different examples, but basically they noticed that the dwarf galaxies had slowly rising rotation curves, and you get bright galaxies, they go up very quickly and flatten out. And even the really brightest ones tended to have declining rotation curves. Okay, so the data have progressed some in that time. And there's the version from the Spark database that we put together. Now plotted log-log, velocity radius, so you can see that. Now I wonder what the logarithmic integral over that is. It's just a recent paper that's made me wonder that. But anyway, you can see by eye now that this shape correlates with surface brightness. So effective surface brightness, that is the surface brightness of the radius that contains half the light. That's a color coding, so red is high surface brightness, blue is low surface brightness. And you can see there's pretty much a perfect rainbow of shapes. Slowly rising rotation curves correspond to low surface brightness. And as you get to higher and higher surface brightness, you get rotation curves that go up steeply and flatten out quickly. So that you just see in the data. And we've known this for a while. Like I said, I make a similar plot like this, over a decade ago. And using optical data, and what you found then was that there was some mixing in the colors. That's just from the scatter and the mass to light ratio. You'd sort of expect that. So it wasn't a perfect rainbow. Now with the near-infrared data, it's an almost perfect rainbow. Ooh, there's a green one there, right? There's always some scatter, but it's this was not really expected in the dark matter paradigm. Okay, so let's come back to our Tully-Fisher pair. Here we're plotting velocity as a function of radius. But what this is telling us is that the shape of the rotation curve knows about the light distribution. So one measure of the light distribution is a scale length, right? So the scale length of the low surface brightness galaxies is large. If I remember right, it's 7 kiloparsecs for this. Only 2 kiloparsecs for that. So let's scale the radius by that scale length. Ooh, they're right on top of each other now. So this is not always true, but it's pretty close to true. And one nice thing, these are very nearly exponential disks, so this exponential scale length actually means something. That's less meaningful when you have a big bulge component or something like that. But they're very nearly the same. So whatever is going on doesn't just know about the total amount of baryons. It also knows about the distribution of baryons, that this is more diffuse than that thing. And that's why this explanation for Tully-Fisher doesn't work. Right, we try to, let's just ignore the baryons, it's all dark matter. Well, dark matter doesn't know about the distribution of baryons, unless you build that in. All right. So, I'm trying to take a step back and take a holistic look at this. Basically, Tully-Fisher we've talked about. It's only talking about that flat part of the rotation curve. More massive galaxies are up here, lower mass galaxies down there. And surface brightness does correlate with mass, but with a lot more scatter. Well, what about this? You also see an effect here at small radii in the slopes of the rates of rise of the rotation curves being different. And indeed, there is a relation there, as I call the central density relation. So this one is not so widely known. At this point, people seem to have figured out Tully-Fisher is a thing. But it's not just the outer part, it's also the inner part. And so what we're plotting here is a measure of the dynamical surface density versus the surface brightness. Right, so this is a measure of the central surface brightness of the stars. Federico Lelli, when he made this plot, took care to match the apertures. So
how well you can measure the dynamical surface density depends on the resolution of the data. So you want to be sure you're comparing apples and apples. So you have to measure that central region in the same aperture. And up at high surface densities, again, you can see a one-to-one relation. Basically, that says the stars are dominating the dynamical mass, just as you saw in the mass model for NGC 2403, that high surface brightness case, and it's right in this clump here. And basically, it's all stars here. But as you go to lower surface brightness, you start to become dark matter dominated, and so the data sit above this one-to-one line. And in fact, it's systematic. The lower the surface brightness, the relatively more dark matter you need. And that's just the way we define the surface density.
So this is a shape we'll see over and over again in the data. And this is just true in terms of the surface brightness. There's a one-to-one thing here, no funny business. You can't perceive the need for dark matter in the inner regions of bright galaxies or high surface brightness galaxies. But you need it already in low surface brightness galaxies. And more than that, it's not a random thing. The lower the surface brightness, the more you need. Okay, so I'll pop this up so you will have the equations in your notes. Not that I expect you will ever need it, but this equation for the dynamical surface density goes back to a paper by Toomrey in 1963, which we didn't know about until Angus Kalnais, the same Kalnais who was concerned that there was any dark matter at all, pointed out that Toomrey had done this. And he helped us generalize it to a finite thickness disk. Toomrey had solved it exactly for a thin disk. This is the thickness of the disk, and that's the only little change that happens to that formula. And you can fit the data with some kind of function. But what matters is the asymptotic limits at high surface densities. It's just one-to-one. The dynamical surface density scales exactly with the surface brightness. And notice that the dynamics depends on this integral, so you do need to have the whole shape and you have to extrapolate, which does not contribute much to this because this is v squared over r squared. So what this really depends on is the rate of rise of the inner part of the rotation curve. That's what carries all the weight in that integral. So what this is telling you is that when the mass is compact, you expect a rapid rise of the rotation curve. When it's diffuse, you expect it to be a slow rise, and that's what we see. And in fact, it's a very systematic thing. So at the low surface brightnesses, you get this weird scaling that basically the dynamical surface density scales is the square root of the surface brightness below this bend. At some critical scale, it's a little under 1,000 solar masses per square parsec. And so it gets bigger and bigger in this way. It's just what the data do. Now, there's a lot of confusion in the literature right now because people keep rediscovering this thing. Like I say, this goes back at least to 1980. And it depends on the scale length or the surface brightness, or however you want to quantify it. It depends on the light distribution. If you take off the empiricist hat and put on a modeler's hat, then you get exactly this reasoning that what you really care about is the shape of the rotation curve of the dark matter halo, which for an NFW halo, like that predicted by lambda CDM, that always looks the same, right? So rotation curves of the dark matter halos of the same mass all have the same rotation curve with some scatter, but they all look pretty much the same. And if the baryons aren't doing anything, then basically all galaxies should look like that. Well, they don't, right? Real galaxies vary in this way, but looking at it this way, the theorist came along and said, okay, well, let's just measure the value at 2 kPc, which is like, duh, we can already do that. All you have to do is query this relation in terms of surface brightness. Well, what happens at 2 kPc? Well, so they did this and said, okay, look, there's a huge diversity in their shapes of rotation curves. This thing has a very large velocity at 2 kiloparsecs. This has a small velocity at 2 kiloparsecs. So this got assigned the name in the literature diversity. There's this diversity in shape. Without checking this, that they're basically the same if you normalize it to the scale length. So really, the story is uniformity, right? That if you know about the scale length of the disk, then you can work out what the shape of the rotation curve will be. And if you just ignore that, you say, ooh, that's very different. So there's a lot of confusion out there as a result of this choice of names, that diversity follows from uniformity just by the choice of definition of radius where you measure it. Does that make sense? It's just how these things scale out and how you choose to interrogate the data. Okay. Another ancillary rule that I've mentioned before is Renzo's rule. Like I say, I had this argument with him a long time ago, and it still holds true, but he took a decade to check it. So you look at a galaxy like this, you see there's an extended gas distribution, there's stars in a spiral disk, and there's also this wee central bulge. So much so that you don't even necessarily call it a bulge in the optical, but it's pretty clearly a bulge component in the infrared where the stellar mass is. So you build a Ross model for that, and there are three components here, right? There's the gas, there's the stellar disk is that blue dashed line, and the red dashed dot line, that is the central bulge component, that wee thing in there. And that thing is only like 5 or 6% of the total light of the system, but it's very concentrated. So Newton teaches us V squared goes as gm over r, and that means there is this inner spike in predicted in the rotation curve by the presence of that bulge component. Even though it's a small amount of the total mass, it's very concentrated, so m over r is pretty big, just because r is small. And so the mass model summing up all these components is that black line. And then the data, here's the famous flat outer part, that's more than this line, so dark matter. But then the shape of this gets to be what the stars predict, including this little up-down-up feature from having the central bulge component. And that's basically something you really need the bulge to be maximal for. That is to say, there is a degeneracy between the dark matter and the disk, and that you could scale down the disk and have more dark matter and get an equally good fit to the rotation curve. But you can't do that with the bulge, because if you turn the bulge down too much, you can't have a dark matter halo that hits that and then drops and then goes up again, at least not for a physically viable mass distribution, right? As long as the mass is monotonically increasing with radius, then it can't do that. So you basically need the bulge to explain that little spike in the central velocities. As an example of Renzo's rule, you see a feature, that bulge, it predicts a feature. You see that feature in the resulting velocities. That's not too surprising, because this is all happening up where you're in that one-to-one relation between surface brightness and mass surface density. But if you get down on the lower surface brightness side of that, it still works. In fact, here's an example where it works in the gas component. So NGC 1560 is this famous dwarf for having this kind of weird feature in its gas distribution. So there's the surface brightness of the stars. There's the surface density of the gas. And it has this weird kink. And in fact, this kink is asymmetric. It's more pronounced on one side than the other. But this still carries through that when you integrate this up and create the mass model, you predict this dip that corresponds to that. Right, so the stars are nice and well behaved. The gas is doing this weird thing. But the gas is most of the baryonic mass in this galaxy. And you see that same kind of shape reflected there. Does that make sense to you?
What's wrong with this picture? Right, I've told you Renzo's rule is a thing, and this is the sort of thing he would expect, because you see that feature there, you see that feature there. But conventionally, this is a spherical dark matter halo. Remember, pressure-supported spheres cannot support these kind of features. This kind of feature is sort of run-of-the-mill. It's a big example in this case. But you see spiral arms, you see bars, you see weird features and disks because of the bar instability. That happens. But here, the amplitude is of the discrepancy is large. This is low enough surface brightness. I'll go back. Right, we're now down here. The bulge of NGC 6496 is up here, 6946. And so, okay, that's normal. Now we're looking at the gas surface densities down here, and the amplitude of the discrepancy is large. This is where the surface brightnesses are high. There's no discrepancy. This is where the surface densities are low, below 10 there. And so the amplitude of the discrepancy is large. Most of the velocity has to be provided by that pressure-supported quasi-spherical dark matter halo. But that shouldn't support any structure there. So that's a weird thing. Renzo's rule should not apply in these kind of situations, but apparently it does. And like I say, that's not widely known outside of people who actively work on rotation curves. It is a fact that should inform theory development that is just basically not known, so it doesn't. Okay, so we've talked about building mass models. You can do this component by component. You can separate the bulge, the stellar disk, the gas disk, because Newton is nice and friendly, and you can add potentials linearly. So you can divide this up into as many components as you like. You could have a molecular gas disk. You could have a dust disk, which is pointless because the dust mass is negligible, but you could do it. For the stellar components, then actually doing this requires you to assign a mass-to-light ratio. So these are components you could always scale up and down by assigning a different mass-to-light ratio. But the gas, that's not true. We know how to count 21 centimeter photons and turn that into atomic gas mass, so that part is at least fixed. Commonly, what's done is to assume the bulge component is spherical and the disk is a finite thickness disk of whatever shape it has. You could approximate it as an exponential, and while that's a good fit to the surface brightness profile, it's pretty lousy dynamically. Same thing for the gas disk. But if you do all that, you can work out what the mass model is, and you can define this quantity, which is the centripetal acceleration that is predicted for the stuff you can see. So
If, like in the solar system, what you saw was what you got, then the observed centripetal speeds would be equal to that predicted baryonic acceleration. All right. Sometimes we can measure surface densities dynamically as well as photometrically. So here's our friend 6946 again. This is a surface brightness profile translated into surface mass density for two different pass bands, one from the K band, which is 2.2 microns, one from the Spitzer, 3.6 microns. Those are similar infrared bands, so they have the same shape overall. The normalization is different. I have to assign a different mass to light ratio for the different bands, and that works out. That is, the stellar populations seem to know what the difference should be. So it's not entirely trivial that these things lie on top of each other. The other thing that's much harder to do is this thing is nearly face on, so you can go and take spectra and try to measure the bulk velocity dispersion to the population. Right, that same thing we do in the Milky Way, looking at how stars oscillate in a disk. And then you can translate that into a surface density, which I lost off of that equation. Dang it. Because basically we're trying to extract that surface density, and for this particular galaxy, this exercise has been done by Enian a few years ago, and those are those black squares. And so you see those agree pretty well. The big uncertainty here is what is the scale height of these things. The galaxy is face on, so you don't get to measure how thick it is when seen edge on. So you have to assume something about that, and they assume something statistical based on observations of similar galaxies seen edge on. But, you know, my point is that there clearly is some stellar mass from the stars, and it more or less matches what you'd expect from the stellar populations. Okay. So remember this hierarchy of approximations we can make. For just looking at the surface brightness profile, an exponential fit to this disk is really good, right? An exponential disk is just a straight line in a log linear space, and then you need the bulge component for the center, so you treat that as a separate quasi-spherical component. But exponential disk is really good at fitting that, but these little subtle wiggles are not negligible in the dynamics, and so you do get this difference between the acceleration that's predicted, the rotation curve that's predicted for the stars by numerically solving the Poisson equation for the observed light distribution, and what you would expect for just an exponential disk. So that matters. It's subtle, but it does matter. And so there's that mass model again with all three of these components and the total. And of course, like I say, you can sum these up. That black line is the sum of the individual components. You can ask what the centripetal force corresponding to that is, and it's clearly smaller than the total centripetal force. So come back there. And you can measure this quantity anywhere. What's the velocity at 2 kbps, there, or less, or more? And is there some way of, you know, relating all these things together? And I've emphasized the acceleration because that's the thing that matters. Acceleration is what follows from the surface density. The surface density is the correlation that you can see by eye, just in that rainbow of color, so that's what matters. Okay, so computationally, what do we do? Here's one galaxy. This is a Spitzer image of this chap here, UTC 3546. Again, you can see spiral features, a bit of a ring, faint spiral arms further out. It has a gas component, but in this case it's mostly stars. So here's the mass model. And the usual way it's depicted, velocity is a function of radius. There's the gas contribution. There's the stellar contribution. And that blue line is the sum. And so that's basically this G bar, the centripetal acceleration predicted by the observed distribution of baryons, right? You're just asking Newton, okay, you see this mass distribution in projection, what's the force? Well, that's the calculation you do. And to which the exponential disk is an approximation, not perfect, but sometimes decent. But the rotation curve is flat, so the observed centripetal acceleration, the actual force that keeps stars on their orbits inside the galaxy, is more than that. And there is some shape to this, so bear that in mind as well. Right? These things are nearly maximal in this case, and you can see that Renzo's rule, that little bump in there, that corresponds to the transition here. And it just looks like nothing, right? If you just plot the rotation curves of these things over and over again, it all looks weird. But where the organization emerges is in the accelerations. So now here are three examples. High surface brightness, galaxy with a dominant central bulge component. Here is a fairly high surface brightness galaxy with no bulge, just a disk. That red line here, that dotted purple line. And then a low surface brightness galaxy with most of its mass in the form of gas rather than stars. So the green dotted line dominates over the stars here. It's not the case in the other galaxies. All right, so three rather different galaxies. One's bulge dominated, one's stellar disk dominated, the other is gas disk dominated. All have different surface brightnesses. And you just look at the rotation curves and the mass models, and there's not an obvious regularity, right? And yet we know from just what our eyes see and that plot that there is a regularity, right? So how do we quantify that? And it turns out you can plot lots of things that don't work. But what does work is the relation between this predicted acceleration and the observed acceleration. All right, so here we're using the observed rotation curve data to compute the observed acceleration, v squared over r, so that's that axis. And the baryonic mass model, that blue line, to quantify the predicted acceleration. And for this exercise, we assume that all galaxies have the same mass-to-light ratio. And that's, observationally, that's a huge step forward. You just couldn't do that with optical data, but with the near-infrared data, it's close enough to pretty much make obvious what's going on. So here are the same rotation curve data plotted over again in terms of centripetal acceleration and predicted acceleration from the baryons. And again, if everything were normal, you'd live on that dashed line, no dark matter, no funny business. And that first relation is that black line, same thing. The data are explained by the stars at small radius, which is high acceleration, so it's on the one-to-one line. But then it starts to deviate, and it does so in the same qualitative way that we saw for the surface densities, right? When you get to low surface densities, you need some discrepancy. Same thing, you get to low accelerations, you get to low surface densities, and so the surface density is related to the acceleration. Right? That's what Newton says. It just Newton doesn't say you should deviate ever from that dashed line. Okay. So you do that over and over again. Well, I didn't belabor this enough. Let me belabor it some more. Right. So this is the line for this galaxy. We've kept it here as a gray line. So that's the same line. Now, add that galaxy on there, and it's this line. Add this galaxy on here, and it's that line.
And so you build up what we now call the radial acceleration relation. As phrased, this is just an empirical relation between what you see and what you get. What you see is the predicted acceleration from the observed distribution of baryons, not making any approximations of exponential disk, just numerically solving the Poisson equation for whatever light distribution nature shows you in each and every case, and that is different in each and every case, right, by a lot. And so this sort of hides that, because there is this incredible uniformity, even assuming the same mass to light ratio for all the galaxies, and there are well over 100 in this plot. They just basically pile up on top of each other over and over again. And you take a cut through that, and it basically looks like a Gaussian distribution with some outliers. There are always some outliers above what the Gaussian predicts, but it's not very bad, especially given that we just assume the same M to L. That can't be true. You know that's going to give you some scatter. Right? And so here's the residual from something. We just made up a function and fit a line to it. Now, there's an older version of this, which I mentioned just because nomenclature is terrible. Nowadays, we call it the radial acceleration relation. Before that, we called it the mass discrepancy acceleration relation. Same thing. Okay. The only difference is that the discrepancy, we were trying to quantify the amplitude of the discrepancy, i.e. how much dark matter do you need. And so this is sort of a plot of how much total enclosed mass you need to the observed mass. So again, if Newton were right and everything were nice and easy, you'd just have that one-to-one line. But you don't, as you go to lower accelerations or equivalently to lower surface brightnesses, you get a bigger and bigger discrepancy, and that's a systematic thing. So that's how much dark matter is. That's the amplitude of the discrepancy. But notice this discrepancy is just the ratio of the total of acceleration to the predicted acceleration. So these axes are not independent, which is why we switched to calling it radial acceleration relation. This has axes that are completely independent. We measure that from the rotation curve, measure that from the surface photometry. Right? Different kinds of data, different things. Okay. So historically that's true. And one of the reasons we went to the effort of building the Spitzer database was because you could already see hints that you would do better by going to the near-infrared for your mass estimator. So here are some data from Verheyen and Sanders in the K-band. It's a small subset of the available data 20 years ago. This is the same thing in the B-band. There was a lot more B-band, and you could use a population synthesis model to try to get the bright mass-to-light ratio. But you don't expect it to work all the time because it's blue, right? And so young stars come and go and make it scatter. And you can see individual galaxies for which it didn't seem to work, or at least it didn't put it on the same relation. But you go to the near-infrared, or from the population models, you don't expect that to be such a problem, and the scatter is much smaller. So not only did we expect from stellar populations that the scatter would go down as we went to the near-infrared, but there was already empirical indications that that was true. We just didn't expect it to be this good. I mean, literally when we first did this, Jim Schomburg and I had been working on this for a decade, and there was just so much data to wrap our heads around. It wasn't until Federico came along as a postdoc and had the time and energy to just put it all together. And so when he first made this plot, he was in the office there. I think it's the same office Tobias is in now.
I think the one I was in.
It was Marcel's?
Before the one I'm
on. The one before, yes, that's right, because he moved down. So anyway, he did this. He plotted it just as I happened to be walking by. He's like, Stacy,
look at this. And it was amazing, because basically you could not see any scatter. We expected there would always be some outliers. And at that level, there just aren't. So, like I say, we made up a function. There's nothing special about this functional form. It actually has a weird history in it. I was trying to find some function that would not predict a noticeable effect in the solar system, because there are easier forms you can come up with, but you would have seen this effect in the solar system with those forms. So here's one where it dies away very fast because of that exponential, and gives you apparently the right shape. And so basically all we're doing is saying that the observed acceleration, that includes all of the sources of mass that contribute to the gravitational potential, both dark matter and baryonic, correlate with just the baryonic acceleration. And so you can write basically a function that says the total is just a function of baryonic, and then there's this weird term, right? If it were just Newton, this term wouldn't be there, and those two things would be equal. And what that term does is say, okay, there's some scale, G dagger, that we fit for, that tells you where this deviates. And then it follows this weird, again, like with the surface density, this effectively square root law at low acceleration, so that faint end. And that scale happens to be of order 1 angstrom per second per second. That's a really weird scale for galaxies, right? We think of angstroms in quantum mechanics. But that's the typical centripetal acceleration that holds a star in its orbit in a galaxy. And that's the only place that we infer the need for dark matter is when the accelerations get low around that scale. Never see them up. The solar system is way up on the top right off the edge of this graph. Don't need any dark matter in the solar system. Okay. The other puzzling thing about this observation was that, again, there was no scatter, no intrinsic scatter. So you can see there's some spread there. You can do the math for what we think the error bars are, and there is some residual scatter. But the dominant term from that is just from the scatter and mass to light ratios. Right, this plot, we assume they were all the same. We know that can't be true at some level. So you can appeal to stellar population models to estimate what scatter that should produce. And that's the red lines, which is basically indistinguishable from the observed scatter. So again, like with Tolle-Fisher, this relation, purely empirical, just what you see and what you get, is consistent with zero intrinsic scatter. It's kind of crazy. Why should those two things be coupled together so well? And that just quantifies what I just said. If you measure the RMS is sensitive to those outliers. It's a bit high. If you just fit a Gaussian, then it has this. And if you do the uncertainty budget, what's left over once you take care of the known errors, of which distances are still a big factor. So you need to know the distance to each individual galaxy, because the acceleration b squared over r depends on that r, so you need to know the distance, right? And you need to know it for each galaxy separately, not just, it's on average a Hubble constant of whatever. But anyway, you ask what's the residual unexplained scatter, and it's basically equal to what you see, and that's what you expect from stars somewhere between 0.1 and 0.15. So that's all of it. So here's a movie showing where each individual galaxy lies on this relation. So you'll see the relation get built up. You'll see some galaxies lie nicely on it. Some galaxies don't. And there are two reasons for that. One is that we got the mass to light ratio wrong, and that would appear as a shift. And one is the shape is wrong. Shape depends on the mass to light ratio choice. because it matters for the stars and not the gas. So that causes some little weird kinks and things in here. The low surface brightness dwarfs all live down here. This end is dominated by the gas. Bulges all live up here, and stellar disks everywhere in between. And so you'd see individual cases are weird, but they're all building up the same relation within the expected uncertainty of the mass to light ratio. So that's the heat diagram there. Now you can say, okay, nature has told us there is this empirical relation. There's no theory in this beyond Newtonian mass modeling. Right, just solving the Poisson equation to get the predicted acceleration from the baryons that are observed and the measured accelerations from rotation curves. So one can say, well, let's just assume that that mean relation is true for everything. What mass to light ratio do I need to put every galaxy right on that line? So basically you're now fitting for the mass to light ratio. There are nuisance parameters, the distance and the inclination, which are literally just a nuisance, but that's a detail of Bayesian fitting. And here's one example. This turns out to have the lowest mass to light ratio in the thing, so it's extremal in that regard, but somebody has to. It just happens to be that galaxy. So you can look at each of these mass models individually, and some of them are pretty good. Some of them not so much, right? But that's, for the most part, that kind of variation is at the level that one expects for astronomical data. So you can do this over and over again, and this is one of the things Pingfei did in his thesis. Now, where are we? One of the worst examples in the sample is NGC 2915. This, okay, well, that's not a big deal, right? But this is a huge discrepancy. Why is that? And so I spent some time chasing back through the literature, because all the rotation curves we collected from the literature, they represented the integrated work of like three decades of a whole bunch of people working very hard in the radio interferometry community. So they were usually published one or a few at a time with differences in analyses and so forth. What we did was to provide the surface photometry for the mass models in a self-consistent way. So this particular galaxy I kept tracing back and back, and they kept citing an earlier paper for the rotation curve data that cited an earlier paper that cited an earlier paper, and I finally got back, and this one galaxy is a very weird, almost face-on, huge atomic gas disk, small, compact, blue, compact dwarf galaxy, and they're like, we don't know what the rotation curve is. Here are four realizations. And one of them did that, one of them did that. I forget what the other examples were. But there are literally four different realizations of the rotation curve, and people had adopted this one in the literature. Well, one of them looked exactly like what was predicted here. So, you know, okay. From a theoretical point of view, you don't get to pick and choose that way, but it seems like the data we adopted were a little arbitrary. And I mention that not to say that this has to be right, because I don't know that, but that sort of thing happens in astronomical data all the time. And you should be aware of the fact that one discrepant case does not the whole show stop. It never ever does. Right. So the important thing is to understand why this happens in general, not why, oh, that's a weird case. Yeah, it is a weird case, but in general, it works pretty well. And in a way that we didn't expect. So now I said the residuals are small. This is the residuals after you fit for their mass to light ratio, and now they're tiny. Of course, we fit for it, so it should be. We asked what parameters put each galaxy right on the line. But the residual scatter is very small. there's an example that what's the best fit value of that characteristic acceleration scale, G dagger. If you let that be free, then it's just always right at that preferred value. There is no value added to your fits by letting that be a free parameter for each every one. Chi-squared improves, of course, if you've added another parameter. But if you just look at the fits by eye, there's no difference. And so another question is, well, what's that distribution of required mass-to-light ratio? And it's basically a constant near the value we had assumed with some scatter, which is what we had hoped for. So again, that's all very reasonable. All right, so I have bored you to tears now, but at least you've all heard all about all these things. Like, people know rotation curves are flat, a fair number of people know about Tully-Fisher, rather fewer people know about these things, and they're all parts of the systematics that we should try to understand. And that acceleration scale keeps coming up again. I've introduced it in terms of that scale where the data bend in the radial acceleration relation. That scale is about 1.2 by 10 to the minus 10 meters per second per second. But remember, there was a bend in the surface density, the central density relation, and you can map that, right? There's just Newton's constant times the surface density. Gives you an acceleration. So you can just say, okay, well, what acceleration scale is that bend? It's 1.27. Pretty much the same as that number. And you can extract a similar acceleration scale from the Tully-Fisher relation just by looking at the units. So the ratio of v to the fourth, that line, to mass is a surface density. At g, it becomes an acceleration. So you can define a characteristic acceleration from the Tully-Fisher relation. And that line is not a fit, except for the normalization. It's just a line of with that slope, v to the fourth. So that works pretty well. Now, a subtle thing that matters here is, remember, the disks are not spheres, so they rotate a little faster than the equivalent spherical mass distribution. So there is this factor of order unity that appears there. You know, people sometimes forget about, so I'll say it there. And all the galaxy data are down at this tiny acceleration scale. So here's accelerations over a ridiculous scale. Here's the solar system, right? We live here at 1g, about 10 meters per second per second. That's 11 orders of magnitude above stars orbiting in galaxies. You can define other acceleration scales where everything is normal. You only notice the dark matter effect of these extremely low accelerations. So there's something important about that acceleration scale, so we will stop there. Do pick up your homeworks. Like I say, everybody did fine. The stat should be alphabetical to these things along there. Mm-hmm.